The Nature Podcast from Nature, the international weekly journal of science, brought to you in association with Bio-Rad. Transform your 2D electrophoresis sample preparation with Bio-Rad's new micro-rotifor cell. On the web at www.expressionproteomics.com.
This week, astronomers have spotted a galactic pileup, and it's right on our cosmic doorstep.
A headlong collision of one galaxy plunging through the disk of the Andromeda Spiral Galaxy to create the most awesome rings of fire.
More on that story in just a moment. Also, how a mud volcano has thrown up some interesting animal interactions in the Barents Sea.
Tube worms are engineering the environment. They are pumping seawater into deeper sediment layer and thereby fostering these anaerobic mesanotrophs at the base of their tubes.
And a crust conundrum for geologists.
There's increasing evidence from work like this that there were sharp pulses of generation of new crust. And it's very hard to see how you can get pulses of generating new crust from these movement of plates on the outside of the Earth.
Chris Hawksworth, who'll be bringing us down to Earth with a look at the origins of the ground beneath our feet. Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and welcome to this week's edition of Nature's Podcast. Now, as we've just heard, scientists have spotted something pretty unusual in our cosmic neighbourhood. Using the Spitzer Space Telescope, David Block and his team have spotted a collision between the nearby Andromeda galaxy and a smaller companion galaxy. And what's really exciting is that, relatively speaking, it's only just happened.
What we are actually reporting in Nature is something quite extraordinary, a head-on collision of one galaxy plunging through the actual disk of the Andromeda Spiral. This is quite extraordinary. Normally, these sorts of collisions are reserved for galaxies in our very distant universe. But to find a head-on collision right on our doorstep is truly riveting.
Is this something that's happened fairly recently then in sort of cosmological time?
I think that this is what makes the research additionally so incredibly exciting, is that, yes, dinosaurs roamed on Earth when this head-on collision actually took place. We estimate that the collision took place only 200 million years ago, which in cosmological context is extraordinarily short.
How did you actually spot it, though, David?
The rings were spotted using the Spitzer Space Telescope. And what is very interesting is Andromeda has a very large, bright, pregnant bulge of stars. And these stars absolutely would masquerade any rings in the optical wavelength regime. But of course, we must remember, using the Spitzer Space Telescope, we start receiving photons of light in the near and in the mid-infrared regime. And what these Spitzer images revealed were two rings, an outer ring of diameter approximately 65,000 light years, and an inner ring. Now, it's this inner ring, which is totally new, which has never been really reported before. The inner ring has a dimension of around 5,000 by 3,000 light years. And this set of two rings are indeed the smoking gun evidence for a head-on collision. Perhaps if I could explain by means of an analogy, if you take a stone and you throw it into a pond of water, it creates a ripple effect. And what we've actually gone and discovered, my team has actually found all these rings, these sets of rings, which point to a very violent past in our closest spiral galaxy.
How do you know it only happened 210 million years ago?
What has been very interesting is that we've been very privileged to work at the Observatoire de Paris in France, and using some of France's most sophisticated computers, they've actually been able to simulate the collision. And what the simulations beautifully prove is that if you set everything up correctly, in order to get the companion galaxy to where it is today, you have to backtrack by only 200 million years for this violent head-on collision to have taken place. And so it's using very sophisticated computer codes that Drs. Bornard and Coombs have actually been able to show that this amazing collision has taken place very, very recently.
David Block from the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, who's found evidence for a headlong collision between our neighbour, the Andromeda Galaxy, and a companion galaxy that formed alongside it. And now to the bottom of the Barents Sea and the Haakon-Mosby mud volcano. Now, this isn't a volcano in the traditional sense. It's a column of sediment and silt, which is formed by escaping water and gas, which is mostly methane. And that methane provides a source of energy to a range of microbes, called methanotrophs, which live in the volcano. But how much of this escaping methane these microbes can consume wasn't known, and nor did researchers expect to find an unusual relationship between these bugs and a form of tube worm. Here's Helga Niemann.
The key thing that we try to find out is what the interactions between geological systems such as mud volcanoes and the methanotrophic microbes living in surface sediments. And here we found out with a fluid flow model why certain groups of methanotrophs stay in a certain area where they are not present in other areas.
But what actually is a mud volcano, and where are they generally found?
Well, mud volcanoes can be found in the marine environment, but also in terrestrial environments. They're very different from a typical volcano you may have in mind, emitting lava or whatever. These structures are more or less like a big pile of mud where fluids and gases rises through its central conduit and are emitted, in the case of marine mud volcanoes, on the seafloor.
And if you could open them up and do a sort of cross-section, what would be the anatomy of them, and how would the microbial flora and fauna relate to that anatomy?
So most part of this mud volcano is usually subsurface. Like in the mud volcano we have been working on, it has its root about 2 kilometers below seafloor, and there is a lot of high pressure due to gravitation, so it's lithostatic pressure, and this creates then gas, and this gas is then rising to the surface. And just in the very thin surface horizon of, well, usually less than a meter, that is the part where the microbes live. And at Haakon-Mosby mud volcano, some of the microbes just live on a very thin biofilm on top of the sediment.
And when you did this work, what was our understanding before you actually did the sampling, and how has it changed the picture now?
Well, the understanding before this was that whenever you find these anaerobic methanotrophs in the sediment, that they consume about 90 to 100% of the uprising methane. And now we found out that because of the hydrodynamical setting at Haakon-Mosby, that quite a lot of that methane is flowing through this biological filter system and is escaping into the water column.
How are you sampling them?
Well, we went there with a so-called ROV, which stands for Remotely Operated Vehicle, which is like a submarine, but nobody is in there, so it's remotely operated. And we have two arms that we can manipulate from the ship. And then we have some device that is called a push core, which is an acrylic core liner that we simply push into the sediment. And then we take these sediments more or less undisturbed back to the surface.
So has anything special come to light about the actual microbes you uncovered?
Yes, the microbes that we found in the center sediment is a new group of aerobic methanotrophs, and especially in the second zone of this mud volcano, we found a new clade of anaerobic methanotrophs, which is now the third or actually the fourth known clade of anaerobic methanotrophs. So this is something pretty new. And another thing that is also new in the outer zone of the mud volcano is that we found an interesting relationship between megafauna organisms, in this case tube worms, that are engineering the environment because they are pumping seawater into deeper sediment layer and thereby flushing these deep sediment layers with electron acceptors, sulfate and oxygen, and thereby fostering these anaerobic methanotrophs at the base of their tubes.
Helga Niemann from the Max Planck Institute in Bremen, Germany. And Helga tells me that these microbes only remove about 40% of that methane bubbling up through the volcano.
Nature's Podcast, bringing the world of nature to life.
Coming up shortly, where does the ground beneath our feet come from? We'll be joining Bristol University's Chris Hawksworth to find out. First, though, to a lonely tortoise in the Galapagos and Joe Marchant, who's been looking at this week's news.
We've got some politics to talk about later, from the upcoming midterm elections in the US to the human cost of the conflict in Iraq. But first I'm joined by Henry Nichols, author of Lonesome George, The Life and Loves of a Conservation Icon, the story of what's believed to be the last surviving giant tortoise from the island of Pinto in the Galapagos, and the scientists who are hoping to find him a mate. Welcome, Henry.
Hello.
First of all, congratulations. I hear your book has been nominated for this year's Guardian First Book Award.
Yes, it has. That's very exciting.
And when do you hear who wins? When's that announced?
It's at the beginning of December.
And good luck for that.
Thank you.
Do you know how Lonesome George is doing now? Are researchers any closer to finding him a female companion?
No, there's an awful lot of work going on in the Galapagos, and it kind of takes priority over George's personal plight.
So we've asked you here to talk about a feature that you've written for Nature this week about a project to make the complete works of Darwin available online. This sounds pretty ambitious. What's it all about?
It's all about getting exactly that. Everything he ever wrote, ultimately, the plan is to get everything he ever wrote, every edition of every book.
How much is that?
It's a lot. I mean, nobody can be quite sure. At the moment, they're about halfway towards all his published work, and that's going to be something like 40,000 text pages, and they're going to have the scans from the papers and from the books as well, alongside that, so you can compare these two things together. And by 2009, they hope to have absolutely everything he published. And then, of course, on top of that, there's everything he didn't publish, and that is just enormous, and we really don't know quite what that entails. There's, tiny little scraps of writing or unpublished manuscripts, like drafts of his Origin of Species and things like that. The launch of this database this week will put the largest amount of Darwin material ever published in it. It's the single biggest Darwin publishing event in history.
And can anybody search this database?
It's going to be free. It's all free and accessible and basically terrific fun.
And is this going to be scientists thinking up new ways to use this data, or is it going to be members of the public just using it for fun, or do they have any idea how the resource will be mainly used?
Well, historians of science will be very excited about it because it will have all editions of all his books, and that's a particularly rich resource, so you can actually then compare the way editions changed over time, the way he changed his language and developed his ideas. So, for example, where does that phrase survival of the fittest first appear? And it doesn't appear in The Origin of Species, first off. It comes into an 1868 edition of Variation of Animals and Plants Under Domestication. And then only the following year, in 1869, does it appear in The Origin of Species. That's actually the fifth edition. So he was developing ways of communicating this grand idea of his. And, he's constantly feeding into these new editions. One thing that scientists will be particularly interested in doing, and that's quite alien, I suppose, to historians of science, is to kind of apply statistical methods to these data and try and work out some interesting stuff. So you could, for example, start to look at how Darwin broke up his time. How long did he spend writing this manuscript until he developed it into that paper? And so you can get a better idea of Darwin, the man.
And finally, just back to the online archives, there are projects being developed at the moment for the works of Newton and Einstein as well. Why is this such a big thing at the moment, and why particularly scientists?
Well, it's just a terrific way of publishing. I mean, what it is achieving is a huge and lasting legacy. And the big ones like the Newton Project and Darwin are going to be free and open to everyone. And what's exciting is that they just kind of don't end, so you can constantly add to these resources. And even when you've published absolutely everything these great people wrote, you can constantly add sort of interactivity and make it much more accessible.
So what's the URL? Where can we find this archive?
It's darwin-online.org.uk.
Great. Well, we'll be making a visit, I'm sure. Thank you for coming in to talk to us about that, Henry Nichols. Now let's move on to another feature in this week's Nature about the upcoming midterm elections in the United States and the role that science is playing in some of these political battles. We're joined by reporter Emma Maris on the phone from Washington. Hi, Emma.
Hello, Joe.
So are scientific issues turning out to be important in the elections this year?
Well, more or less. There are a couple of issues that are somewhat related to science that have come up. One is stem cells and one is the notion of energy independence. Some Republican candidates are moving away from George Bush's position on stem cells. He likes to limit the number of lines that can be used. And energy independence has really resonated with voters because it kind of combines the concern about gas prices with concerns about Middle Eastern geopolitics and about climate change. So it's a nice little tidy buzzword that a lot of candidates are using to tout their credentials.
You've been following some of these races for Nature. Which ones are you watching most closely?
Well, two that I would flag up. One is sort of a fun race, I guess, in a political sense, is Richard Pombo against Jerry McNerney. This is for a House of Representatives seat. Richard Pombo is head of the Resources Committee, and he is very much pro-development, pro-landowner. People in the environmental community hate his guts. And the man running against him is a Democrat who is actually a wind engineer and he has a PhD in mathematics. So it's very much a polar opposite race, and it's very tight now, so it'll be interesting to see who wins there. Another one I'd mention is Heather Wilson, Republican in New Mexico, running against Patricia Madrid for another congressional seat. Heather Wilson is on the League of Conservation Voters' Dirty Dozen for her ties to the oil industry, but she's very pro-stem cells. So while she talks about how great stem cell research is, her opponent talks about how we need to do something about climate change.
So apart from these individual races, what's at stake more generally? We hear that the Democrats are looking more and more likely to win control of one or both houses of Congress.
Right, and if they do, there could be some actual sort of policy repercussions. If they gain control of the Senate and Congress, they will gain control of all the committees they're in, and they will have a lot more influence on what kind of laws get passed, and certainly what kind of congressional hearings are held.
Great, thanks very much, Emma. And now we'll go to Jim Giles, one of our reporters in London, to talk about what's been one of the most controversial stories of the past week, a study out in The Lancet, which estimated Iraq has suffered around 650,000 excess deaths since the US-led invasion in March 2003. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
650,000, that sounds like a very high figure.
It's a huge number, and it's surprising for almost everyone involved. I mean, the other figures that are out there, there's one, for example, from the Iraq Body Count, which is a website that compiles death rates from media reports. That's quoting a maximum of about 49,000. There was a survey out in 2004 by the United Nations that quoted a maximum of 29,000. So this is really an order of magnitude bigger than anything that's come before it.
So what did these researchers do differently to come up with this estimate?
The main difference here is the methodology that they use, which is much more comprehensive than that being used by the other groups. They surveyed almost 2,000 households in Iraq using a methodology similar to that which opinion pollsters use when they're doing opinion surveys. And every reported death, for example, they asked for a death certificate to confirm that. They got that in about 92% of cases. Then they did statistics on it to work out the confidence interval of their results. So the 650,000 figure actually spans a range of 390,000 up to 940,000, and that's a 95% confidence interval. So although that's a huge range, even the bottom end of that interval, almost 400,000, is still much, much bigger than anything anyone else was coming up with. So on the face of it, this result looks pretty robust.
And presumably it was peer-reviewed as well. I mean, what do other researchers in the field have to say about the methodology?
Yeah, it was peer-reviewed. It was The Lancet published it on a fast-track process, which is a process they apply when they want a paper to get out there as quickly as possible. But the rigour of the peer review doesn't differ. It was seen by four peer reviewers, all of whom recommended publication with only minor changes. And I've been talking to a lot of other researchers who are familiar with this type of work, and they say that they're very surprised by this result because it's so much bigger than they expected. But no one can point to a flaw which totally undermines this study.
I guess whatever the figure, it's clear that in life and death terms, the situation has got much worse for Iraqis since the conflict began. How is this being received by politicians?
Well, it depends which side of the political spectrum you're on. I mean, President Bush was pretty quick to rubbish this. He said it was based on a flawed methodology. As many people have pointed out, that's quite amusing, seeing as it's based on the same methodology that's used to produce opinion polls, which, of course, politicians are used to taking very seriously. And there's been, as you'd expect, quite a backlash on the blogs from people who supported the invasion, who've been seeking to find problems with this result. There's also quite a lot of comment from statisticians who have been looking over it and looking at some of the criticisms being made. And as I said, none of them appear to really undermine it.
And what happens now? I mean, are there plans for more sort of even bigger, more rigorous studies?
Yeah, Gilbert Burnham, who is the Johns Hopkins University researcher who came up with this, who ran the study from the US in collaboration with Iraqi colleagues, says he would like to go back and do more work. He says he wants a sample size 4 to 5 times bigger to really narrow down those confidence intervals. And he wants to look in more detail about some of the demographics of the situation. Are people leaving the country? Where are they going? What's happening to the health system, for example? That was something which he wasn't able to bring out because so many of these deaths are due to violence. Causes, we don't really know whether the health system is suffering or not, and whether people are dying because of a breakdown in healthcare. Professor Burnham says that at this stage he doesn't think that they can really justify going back and taking more numbers given the security situation, just sending the researchers out there as a security risk because they could, of course, be targeted by insurgents. Given that, he doesn't want to go back until the security situation improves.
This is Nature's podcast from the 19th of October edition of Nature with me, Chris Smith. Don't forget that all of the reports in this week's show are available on our website at nature.com/nature, and you can drop us a line if you want to podcast@nature.com. Now, finally this week, I went digging into the evolution of the Earth's crust with Bristol University's Chris Hawksworth to look for the big questions that geologists are struggling with today.
The big question is really twofold. One is when the continental crust was generated, and secondly, whether we can get a handle on how it was generated, particularly by trying to understand the rates at which new crust was itself formed.
Where does it actually come from, the crust that makes up the continent?
The crust comes from the underlying mantle, and in essence that is the sort of semi-plastic layer on which the plates of the outside of the Earth move around on. And most simply, if you decompress that mantle, you will melt it, and from that melt you will make new crust. And if you differentiate it enough, if you change its composition enough, you will make the more buoyant rocks of the continental crust.
So how does the evolution of the continental crust differ from, say, seafloor?
The continental crust is relatively buoyant, and so it's quite hard to destroy. So once you make new crust, it has a fair chance of surviving for billions of years. While the rocks of the ocean floor are relatively dense, and so when the ocean floor meets a continent, it gets subducted down underneath the continent and destroyed. So the oldest rocks in the oceans are about 180 million years old, and the oldest rocks on the continents are about 3.8 billion years old.
So what sorts of measures are people able to use and employ to try to get to the bottom of where the crust actually came from and how it's evolved over time?
One of the main things is to find some kind of representative archive of when new crust was generated. Our main problem is that much of the crust was generated a long time ago, and we don't have very many rocks from a long time ago. What many people are now using is this mineral zircon, which is sometimes seen as a jewel, but it crystallizes out of granitic magmas, and once it's formed, it's very hard to destroy. So when you erode your granite and make new sediment, the zircon grains are still preserved in that sediment. And you can go along and collect them and try and analyze them and see when the magmas, the liquids that zircon came from, were themselves derived from the mantle and made new crust.
So was the crust produced in a very even and gentle and progressive rate that was pretty continuous over time, or was it much more discontinuous than that?
The data at the moment shows that if we look at the last billion years of Earth history, that the crust was generated at a relatively consistent rate. But if we go back in time, there's increasing evidence from work like this that there were sharp pulses of generation of new crust. And the implication of that is it's very hard to see how you can get pulses of generating new crust from these plate tectonic processes, from these movement of plates on the outside of the Earth.
So what do you think was going on to make that happen then?
Well, a common view is that they instead reflect some kind of thermal instabilities deep in the Earth. And those instabilities manifest themselves as uprising hot material that then melts, and a large volume of new crust is made in quite specific events. And these are what are called mantle plumes, which there's some controversy about at the moment.
Do we actually know what gives rise to that thermal instability in the first place, though?
Only that there's a lot of heat within the Earth that needs to escape. And one way that heat does escape is to concentrate into focused pockets of rock that tries to move up and convect the heat out towards the outside of the Earth.
So does this mean it could happen again, and we could be looking at more land area to accommodate our burgeoning population?
No, I suspect not. What's happening is two things. One is that the Earth is getting cooler, and secondly, if we look at the record in the recent past, while there have been large volcanic eruptions, these make discrete volcanic provinces. They don't make large volumes of new continental crust.
So if you were hoping to snap up some cheap real estate off the back of a burst of new crust formation, it's bad news, I'm afraid. That was Bristol University's Chris Hawksworth, who's been looking at the origins and evolution of the Earth's crust. Well, that's it for this week, and thanks very much for listening. Please do join me next time, when I'll be hearing how researchers have found a way to tune up different brain connections. In the meantime, if you're in the mood for more science, this week's edition of The Naked Scientists takes a look at the science of sight, including the workings of the retina, the fish equivalent of infrared cameras, and what medicine can do to restore vision amongst those with failing sight. That's The Naked Scientists podcast, which is freely available from thenakedscientists.com. This week's programme was produced by Derek Thorne, Anna Lacey, and by me, Chris Smith. Until next week, goodbye.
The Nature Podcast is sponsored by Bio-Rad, at the centre of scientific discovery for over 50 years, and on the web at discover.biorad.com.